Why should New Zealanders care so much about this?
Because your children will curse you if you don't.
The Wire.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. Let us know your thoughts on any of our pieces today. Text in on 5395. Since October, the Gaza Strip has been experiencing one of the largest escalations of violence it has seen in years, with the death toll of civilians now surpassing 13,000 as of 22nd of November. UNICEF have described the conflict as a humanitarian crisis that will cause lifelong psychological trauma for Gaza's citizens. Senior lecturer in comparative and international education at the University of Auckland, Dr. Ritesh Shah, published a report in January in collaboration with the Norwegian Refugee Council detailing the impacts of the Israeli occupation of Gaza, the West Bank and East Jerusalem on the optimism and mental health of Palestinian children prior to the 7th of October, with a particular focus on the role of education and the impact of COVID-19 and home-based learning on their well-being. Otto spoke to Dr. Shah about his research in the occupied Palestinian territories, the state of Palestinian children's mental health, and measures introduced by NGOs and the UN to create safer learning and working environments for Palestinian students and teachers. Here is that interview.
So, can you give us a brief introduction about your survey on the mental well-being of school children in Gaza?
So effectively, what we were aiming to do, and this was done in partnership with the Norwegian Refugee Council, is to assess and track children's mental health and well-being over four successive years. And what was unique about it is that it gave us an ability to kind of look at a group of children over time and to see how a range of circumstances that occurred in that period were affecting on these young people's mental health and well-being. Around every year, we would survey around 800 students in total across West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, looking at areas that were both most acutely affected by the ongoing conflict and areas that were less affected by the conflict.
Even though, you know, the children in Gaza, this is not the most recent conflict is not the only conflict that they've lived through. They've been through multiple conflicts and air raids in the past. But in previous surveys, they did show higher levels of optimism for their future. But that this decreased in surveys that you conducted as recently as 2021. So what are the factors that have led to this decline in optimism?
I think two major things. I think firstly, COVID-19 affected Gaza in particular quite hard. Because the borders of Gaza are controlled entirely by the state of Israel, during times where COVID was quite rampant, the Israeli authorities effectively shut down the borders entirely. Alongside that, I think just economically, that the ongoing kind of blockade, the kind of closure of public services, and along with increasing pressures and tensions that existed between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas, meant that many public service employees were also not paid for large periods of time. So there was significant economic hardship that was occurring in Gaza in particular throughout COVID-19. The other thing to keep in mind is that daily living circumstances in Gaza are not great. Houses are overcrowded, electricity is sporadic. And so then when you ask children to learn in those circumstances from home remotely, it proved very difficult. We found that less than one in four students were regularly engaging in any form of online learning during the pandemic, which in Gaza stretched on for kind of two and a bit years of on and off closures. And so coming out of that, they had spent large amounts of time stuck in their homes in not very pleasant circumstances. And unfortunately, where it is fairly well documented that there are quite high instances of domestic violence. And for children in Gaza, going to school is really a source of hope, a source of almost seeing a future beyond the walls of their home and the walls that surround Gaza. They hear of people getting out of Gaza, being on scholarships overseas. There is still a very strong narrative in Palestinian culture and society that education is the ultimate form of liberation and also the key form of resistance. So those narratives enable education to be the source of hope in the place of Gaza. So when children weren't in school, and not able to both feel that they had that opportunity, but also to connect with others outside the home, to have an excuse to leave the home, that really impacted on their well-being. And then, unfortunately, soon after schools were fully reopened, there was a major escalation in kind of April, May 2021. And children recounted to me quite vividly how they had only just started to get used to coming back to school, to enjoy reconnecting with their friends and teachers, when all of a sudden their world was thrown up in the air again. And it was quite a violent escalation. There were lots of civilians again who ended up being casualties, particularly in the south of Gaza that time. And after that period, children felt pretty despondent. They felt that they had been forgotten, that no one really cared for them, and that effectively that there was that the thing that they held on to, this idea of hope, had really kind of eluded them in the last 3 or 4 years. And so what we saw as of the survey that we did at the beginning of the last academic school year was that less than 1 in 4 children saw any sort of hope for the future. And in addition to that, you know, most of them noted that they were struggling to stay focused on their schoolwork, were struggling to concentrate, were struggling to manage their emotions. So the real significant concerns in terms of all matters of well-being for children in Gaza.
So in your study, I think that you mentioned that the effects of COVID and home-based learning had different effects for children in the West Bank and East Jerusalem compared to that of children in Gaza. So would you be able to tell us a bit more about that?
One thing to just understand between the difference of the nature of the conflict between Gaza and West Bank and East Jerusalem is that in Gaza, when there are not these major escalations of the kind that we are seeing now, there is very little daily presence of the Israeli occupation, other than the fact that, of course, the blockade is there. People don't have free mobility in and out, and access to things like electricity, water, fishing rights are limited. But when you live in East Jerusalem or you live in many parts of the West Bank, the presence of the occupation is there on a daily basis. That means Israeli settlers, living in close proximity to you, or have you needing to pass through them on your way to and from school each day. Needing to go through military checkpoints, because when there are these settlements, the settlements are protected by the Israeli military. And so when children need to move from one part of their community to another, and they're passing next to, around, or near a settlement, they oftentimes have to go through these checkpoints. And on top of all that, schools themselves have been known to be attacked by both the military, the Israeli military, and settlers. And this is also very well documented. On average, there's about 200 such attacks per year in parts of the West Bank on schools and other education facilities. So in that circumstance, if you are a young child who has to deal with those circumstances on a day-to-day basis, going to school is actually a risky business. It's a threat. And so when schools shut down in West Bank and East Jerusalem, children described how, in some ways, it was a relief. It was a relief not to have to deal with that struggle, not to have to worry about whether you were going to be harassed, whether someone was going to throw a bottle at you, whether you're going to be impeded from going to school that day and turned around at a checkpoint, whether a soldier might harass you and potentially threaten you with arrest. And then the other thing that's different about West Bank and East Jerusalem is just the economic circumstances. The economic well-being of households in East Jerusalem and West Bank on the average is much better than it is for people in Gaza. And so parents were firstly better able to support their children with distance learning. There were much higher rates of engagement. They had much better internet connectivity. They had regular electricity. They didn't have to worry about access to drinking water for the most part. So it was a very different lived experience for young people to be at home during the pandemic in West Bank and East Jerusalem than it was for children in Gaza.
Okay, so just related to the impacts of security and military checkpoints on the well-being of Palestinian children, what could the international community or any other organizations do to ensure that teachers and students in the West Bank and East Jerusalem have safer journeys to schools and more comfortable working environments?
There's a few measures afoot already, and there's been efforts put in place to try to address this. So there's a global declaration called the Safe Schools Declaration, which was developed and ratified at the level of the United Nations a few years ago. And what the Safe Schools Declaration says is that schools should be not used as sites of attack, and that learners and educators should have unimpeded access to education facilities. However, the challenge is that we can have these declarations, but then you need, firstly, governments to agree to sign up to this and then to follow it. And unfortunately, that's where the challenges lie. To my knowledge, I don't believe the state of Israel has signed that declaration. There has been significant pressure for them to do so. But on a day-to-day basis, what many organizations, both international and local non-government organizations and UN agencies do is they actually provide what's called a protective presence. So they literally will walk students to school with their UN vest on or with their vest of their organization on in an almost convoy to ensure that the children are not harassed or bothered on their way to school. But of course, that's not a sustainable solution. That's not something that's going to address the concern on a long scale basis. So it is really, I think, around having you know, governments sign up to and commit to following through on something like the Safe School Declaration. And then if they're not, there have to be some ramifications to the breach of these rules, whether it's through sanctions, whether it's through condemnation. But I think that's the kind of work that needs to be done. And there, it's not to say that this isn't already happening, that this concern hasn't already been voiced and vocalized. But as we've seen with the current situation in Gaza, for example, it's very difficult to get the United Nations as a body to kind of make a statement with a strong stance at the moment.
So does the Palestinian Ministry of Education or any other Palestinian authority government bodies, do they have the power to implement any of the changes that would be needed to improve the well-being of school children?
They do and they don't. The Palestinian Ministry has shown commitment to trying to put in place programs of support for young people to support their well-being. They recognize that it's a significant concern and issue. That includes things like, you know, ensuring there's sufficient numbers of counselors in schools, training all their teachers on basic social emotional learning techniques and psychosocial support approaches. And they oftentimes do this in partnership with various international and local non-government organizations. One of the challenges, though, for the Palestinian Authority is one of budget. The Palestinian Authority is funded through tax revenue, And at the moment, that tax revenue is collected by the Israeli authorities, who then decide how much of that revenue they will hand over to the Palestinian authorities. And so there are lots of instances where the Israelis have either threatened or withheld parts of that tax revenue from the Palestinian Authority, making it quite difficult for the PA to do that work that they want in the education sector. And then in Gaza, it's even more complicated because there's a de facto government in the form of Hamas, and Hamas and the Palestinian Authority do not necessarily align well with each other and do not engage well with each other. And the consequence of that then is that the Palestinian Authority then also withholds funding to the government in Gaza. And that is then coupled with the fact that many international organizations and donors, because they list Hamas in its entirety as a terrorist organization and do not recognize the distinction between the military arm and the political arm, it means that international monies, donor support, cannot go to fund Palestinian-run schools in Gaza. So in Gaza in particular, there's a significant issue with a lack of funding because they're not getting the same, they're not able to get the same level of support as they are with some of the schools and jurisdictions in East Jerusalem, West Bank. And then lastly, just to say that on top of all of this complexity is the system that's run by an organization called UNRWA, which is the UN Refugee and Works Authority. And they were set up to basically care for Palestinians who were displaced out of Israel in at the time of this State of Israel's formation. And so in Gaza, for instance, they have responsibility for the education of 50% of the population. So you actually have two education systems that are operating in Gaza, but also in East Jerusalem and West Bank, that the percentages of those who are receiving support from UNRWA are less.
And that was Senior Lecturer in Comparative and International Education at the University of Auckland, Dr. Ritesh Shah, discussing his research on the impact of ongoing Israeli conflict on children and Gaza's mental health.